Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rachel Cotton from Cascadia Partners. It looks like, I apologize, we started right on the dot at 3. So if anyone was trying to come into the meeting a little bit beforehand, I don't believe it was working, but should be now. And I see lots of attendees popping in. Jacqueline, I'm going to promote you to panelist.
Hey there. Sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Is the link now that everybody can get on there? Because
that's what I just said. So I apologize, but we started right on the dot at 3. We had another Zoom running back to back with this. Okay. So I see 16 people in our attendance room. I'm going to ask if anyone would like to be a panelist, so city staff or any city councilors or planning commissioners, if you would prefer to be shown on camera, please just indicate so in the chat and I can promote you. I see Lance with a hand up. Lance, are you able to unmute?
Am I unmuted now?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay.
Did you have a comment or?
Oh, I was just wanting to join the meeting, but I can participate as a listener or, as more.
Okay, I'm going to just have you participate as a listener. And then, John, did you have a comment?
No.
Okay. So just to clarify, it looks like a few folks are maybe raising their hands inadvertently, but just to be clear, the format here is webinar so that we're just going to present some slides between now and 4. I'll share my screen in a moment. And then we'll leave about 20 minutes for questions and answers at the end. And you can also be typing those into either the Q&A or the chat, which you should see at the bottom of your screen. And then in the interest of time, I'll just get started here. So my name is Rachel Cotton. I'm a senior associate with Cascadia Partners. We are the consultants that are working on the housing needs analysis for Yahats. I'm joined by my colleague, Jamin Kimmel, and we'll be switching off doing part of the presentation and answering questions today. And so just to get us started here, a little bit of, so we were doing introductions. I'll give a little bit of background on the project because I know we have different levels of familiarity with this work. We have some members of our project management team here in attendance today. So they have some background, and I know in your packets were included 2 memorandums that should provide some background, but we'll do a review today as well. Jamin will cover the housing needs projection, so our draft data, and then we'll go through our buildable lands inventory findings, talk about some next steps in terms of the project, and then we, as I mentioned, will answer questions for about the last 20 minutes of the presentation. And just to confirm, can everyone see the screen and the slides? Okay. So just some background information. What are Yahats' housing needs? And why are we doing this project? So no matter if you're a renter or looking to own, housing in Oregon is becoming less affordable, available, and attainable. I'm guessing this is not news to anyone who's joining today. But There are limited housing options to meet needs for both existing and future residents of Yahats. There's also no established roadmap for understanding and determining the types of housing that are most needed and to what degree. Luckily, Yahats has been awarded funding through the state of Oregon, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, to tackle this problem by evaluating the city's housing needs. So that's the housing needs analysis, and then also identifying actions and solutions to address those housing needs. This whole process is called the housing needs analysis. And what is a housing needs analysis? It's a study of the city's existing and future housing needs. And it's used to determine if the city has enough land zoned for housing to meet projected needs over 20 years. It also helps the city determine if more land is needed for specific types of housing, such as apartments or single family detached houses. So we're taking a look at not only the entirety of the city and the land that's available for housing development, but also by housing type and income level, the projection over 20 years and whether or not the city is able to meet those needs under existing conditions. The findings of an HNA also help the city identify actions and solutions to facilitate development of housing that's needed, such as zoning changes or incentive programs. And you can see to the right are sort of some categories of options a city might use as tools to produce needed housing as determined by the housing needs analysis. For short, you'll hear me call it the HNA. So now hopefully when somebody says HNA, those listening will understand what that means. And then what will happen after the HNA is complete and adopted by the city? So once the HNA has been adopted, the city will begin to implement actions and changes that were identified in the plan. This may include additional planning processes, potentially initiating a zoning code update, maybe rezoning certain areas, potentially expanding the urban growth boundary, establishing incentive programs and other actions. And I want to emphasize, particularly for this group, that each of these actions will involve public outreach and engagement, and the actions will be implemented over several months or years. I'll get into our project schedule sort of after we've gone through the data with you, so toward the end of the presentation today. But I want to emphasize that this housing needs analysis is the more technical piece in a two-phase project. And the second phase is called the housing implementation plan. And that'll really sort of like, once we go through all the data, we get feedback, we crunch the numbers, we produce the projections of needed housing, then we start to take a look at the policy and tools and regulations that relate to housing within Yahats and potentially some ideas for what could change if there are areas where we don't anticipate the needed housing can be produced under those existing conditions. And also, given that we are going to be talking to community members starting right now with this meeting, kind of getting a better idea of tools that the community may be more supportive of than other tools and sort of identifying maybe some challenges related to certain strategies. And now I will turn over to Jamin to go through our housing needs projection, which again, you should have received the draft memorandum covering this data.
Yeah, hi everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep. Rachel, my video, it won't let me turn on my video. So I'll go ahead and get started with the presentation, but maybe you can see if you can troubleshoot that. Oh, there it is. Oh,
sorry about that, Jamin. I had to promote you one more time.
All right. So hi again, everyone. So I'm Jamin Kimmel. I'm a partner with Cascadia Partners, and I'm functioning as the principal in charge in this project. I've been doing land use planning and planning for housing in Oregon for several years now. And yeah, looking forward to giving you a little bit more background on what we're finding so far about IHATSE's housing needs, and hopefully getting your input on whether you think this is reflective of the community and is a good summary of what you experience on the ground living in IHATSE. So first off, we'll go over the population growth forecast. So probably the most important element of trying to understand what types of housing and how much housing is needed in the future in IHATSE is an understanding of the projected population in the future. And so IHATSE reached a record high population just recently in 2021 based on census estimates, which put it at about 1,000 people, 1,010. And the IHATSE urban growth boundary, that's UGB, is projected to add an additional 209 people over the next 20 years. And so that's between here now and approximately 2040. And that projection comes from the Population Research Center at Portland State University. Just important to know that those are projections that are required by the state for every city and county to use in doing their housing planning. And so the city is kind of required to use that projection. So that's our baseline assumption about future population growth is that projection provided by PSU. Another important demographic change that we wanted to highlight and relates to housing needs is the aging of the population. And this is a general demographic trend that's happening over time throughout the country, particularly as the baby boomer cohort grows older. But it is slightly more pronounced in IHATSE, and we're seeing that the median age has been increasing over the past decade, and the median age in IHATSE is much higher than Lincoln County or the statewide average. So that's relevant to housing needs as we think about people who may be interested in downsizing in kind of aging in place. So living in the same neighborhood or city that you currently live in, but having housing options that may be a better fit for someone as they reach, as they become elderly and may not want the larger house that has more to maintain and may have issues with accessibility and such. So go ahead and go to the next slide. Another thing we take a close look at that relates to housing need is household sizes. And so how many people are there in every household? And consistent with trends across the country, but not necessarily in Oregon, is that household sizes in IHATSE are getting smaller. And so this probably also reflects the median age increasing. It's common to see that those two factors relate, but it also may be related to perhaps less families are coming to IHATSE and able to find housing in IHATSE. So you may be seeing more a mix of retirees that are smaller households or single, young single people living in IHATSE. Those smaller household sizes do tend to demand for smaller housing units, which makes sense. One of those kinds of smaller housing units, in addition to just your kind of standard apartment building, are a concept called middle housing, which are housing that is kind of a smaller building. So if you think of like a townhouse or a duplex or triplex, or even an accessory dwelling unit, which is adding a small additional dwelling unit on the same site as a single family house. So we said, given those trends, we're seeing that there may be demand for those kind of housing types, which can provide smaller units. Go ahead to the next one. So we also look at household incomes to give us a sense of the demographic trends that are happening in the community and housing needs. And so one way we look at that is we think illustrative of some of the housing issues the city sees is taking a look at how many lower income households are there in the community and what share of the overall population does that make up of. And so we use a data set from United Way actually that looks at the share of households that are experiencing poverty. So this is a little broader definition of what poverty means than the US Census uses. It incorporates a number of other costs of household essentials for living. So in 2018, about 43% of households in Yahats were living in poverty or classified as economically distressed. So that's the term that the ALIS data set uses. And so while that is not much higher than the state average, that is a number that often surprises people when you present this data, is just how many households are living in either in poverty or are economically distressed and are kind of trouble making ends meet. And so that number is 43% in Yahats, which is slightly lower than Lincoln County as a whole, but is also consistent with the state of Oregon in terms of the state of Oregon has a similar share. This data is from 2018. So that's a big disclaimer on this is that given the trends we've seen during the pandemic, it's likely that the number of households that are economically distressed has increased. Can you go ahead to the next slide? So we also take a look at the existing housing inventory. So what does the existing housing stock look like? And that gives us a starting place for projecting what the future housing stock will look like. And so in total, there's 783 housing units in Yahats. And those are split across starting off, 61% of those housing units are estimated to be for seasonal vacant or for sale uses. So I would assume that we can assume that the great majority of that 61% is for seasonal uses. As we know in Yahats, there's many second homes and short-term rental homes. In terms of breaking it down by housing type, you can see that about 80% of the housing in Yahats is single family detached housing. And then the remainder 20% is split across multifamily build units, which are in larger buildings that have five or more units. And then townhomes or plexes, which is kind of refers to that term I just went over, the middle housing. So these are attached units, but they're in smaller buildings, so less than four units in one building. So I think the key takeaway here is that most housing in Yahats is single family detached. That probably makes sense to all of you, just so what you know. It's good for us to put a number on this so that we can consider that as we think about what the future housing need might be. Go ahead, Rachel. So what about tenure? So how many housing units are occupied versus owners or renters? And so based on the data we have, it looks like about 55% of the housing in Yahats is owner occupied, with the great majority of that owner occupied housing being in single family detached houses. So very few, or even no, I'm not sure if we found any townhomes or plexes or multifamily units, so condos, that are owner-occupied, very few. So it is important to note that 45% of the housing in Yahats is renter-occupied, and many of those units are in single-family detached houses. So there are single-family detached houses that are operating as rentals. Ownership, I mentioned, is most prevalent among single-family detached and manufactured housing. All the other housing types are primarily limited to rentals. Go ahead and go to the next line. Okay, so another way we look at housing needs and issues is to try to understand how many housing or households in Yahats are experiencing rent burdens. And so rent burden is defined as when a household spends more than 50% of their income on rent, and that is considered a severe rent burden. So as you can imagine, if one is spending more than 50% of income on rent, then that is probably causing distress in other parts of the household life and being able to make ends meet. And so current data shows that about 25% or one in four households in Yahats are experiencing severe rent burden. And with the this data as well, it is likely that number has increased due to the pandemic, as we've seen that housing costs have risen and incomes have not risen to go along with those housing costs. Go ahead, Rachel. The other thing we look at to try to better understand what housing needs are the workers and commuting patterns. So trying to understand how many of the workers that have jobs in Yahats are able to actually live in the community. And so, as we mentioned, Yahats has a population of about 1,000 people, yet there is only 509 jobs in the community. And so we know that many, many workers commute into Yahats from neighboring communities and unincorporated areas in Lincoln County or in neighboring cities. To put a number on it, about 90% of jobs in Yahats are filled by workers that are living outside of the city. A good majority of those workers commute less than 10 miles to their job. So that tells us that they're probably living in, most of those are living in unincorporated areas in the county outside of the city. But there are a good portion of workers, another 30% of those commuters that commute between 10 and 50 miles, or even another 20% that commute greater than 50 miles. And so we make the assumption in looking at this data that there are likely many workers that would prefer to live in Yahats if they could find housing in the community, but are likely choosing to commute. Some portion of those are choosing to commute because of the law, because of the difficulty in finding housing. Go ahead to the next slide. So median home prices is something we look at to try to understand housing issues. And so as with trends we're seeing across the country, home prices have been increasing rapidly. It's throughout Lincoln County, but also in Yahats. And so this data gives you a sense of how Yahats compares to other cities in Lincoln County. In terms of the annual increase in home prices. And so in January of 2020, the median home price in Yahats was $334,000. In January of 2022, and this year, that median home price has grown to $492,000. So part of that is due to some of the economic dynamics that occurred related to the pandemic. But it also is on a trajectory that was going up prior to the pandemic as well. So we don't believe this is a short-term blip in housing prices. This is likely, while housing prices may not increase at the same rate in future years, they're also not likely to return to levels they were before the pandemic. So that's a 21% increase year over year in median home prices, which is similar to a lot of other places in the county. Next slide. Okay, so now we're moving to our projection for housing needs in the Yahats UGB. We get there by taking the population growth that we expect over the next 20 years, so between now and 2043. We subtract out people that are living in group quarters, and then estimate the amount of population that will that would be part of more kind of family households, apply an average household size to that, and then make a big adjustment for vacancy and seasonal housing. So these are units that are currently, so we assume that 61% of new units would operate as vacancy or as seasonal housing or be vacant at least part of the time. And so that assumption then means that we actually need more housing for the future population that's going to live in the community and not be part of the demand for seasonal housing. So the total number of dwelling units we project to be needed over the next 20 years is 294. And then we break that number down in a couple of different ways. The first one we show here gives you a sense of how that is breaking down by housing or by income level and how that relates to various housing types. Generally, there's a good portion of the community that will fit into the kind of upper income categories, making 120% or more of the median family income. Maybe typically living in kind of a standard single family house. At the same time, there is also a good portion of the community that are kind of upper middle, lower middle, or lower income. And the types of housing that are more attainable for those households are usually not standard single family homes, but are smaller cottage homes, townhomes, apartments, manufactured homes. And so the city needs to plan for and think about how the policy and code allows for those housing types as well. Go ahead to the next slide. Okay, so then one other way that we break down the housing needs is the projected housing needs by the type of structure they're in. And we do this so that we can then compare the projected housing needs over the next 20 years to the supply of land to build that housing. And so in the city's zoning code, it regulates different types of housing. And so we need to understand what is the projected need for each type of housing and how much land is available to build that housing based on the city's existing zoning. And so that's why it's important to do this breakdown. We've assumed for the sake of this initial draft of the housing needs projection that the mix of housing types remains constant into the future. And so that, as you can see in those first two columns in this table, about 80% of the single family, or 80% of the housing stock today is single family. We assume that 80% of the new housing units are also single family, with then a smaller portion of the new housing units that are developed being townhomes or plexes or multifamily units or manufactured homes. So this is a good point to, something we'd like to point out as something to get your input on as members of the public and as well as the Planning Commission and City Council is based on the demographic data we've seen on some of the housing issues we've talked about, the city can modify this projected housing mix to kind of treat it as a target rather than simply just a projection. So if it, as a matter of policy, the city would like to encourage more of the non-single family types, so such as townhome plexes and multifamily, then we can modify this projection and then use that information to have get a more realistic assessment of the city's land supply based on the stated policy preference for a certain mix of new housing. And so that's one thing to keep in mind as we go through the next portions of the presentation is is whether or not you believe that the city should plan for a different housing mix in the future and have a wider variety of housing types being developed than are now. Okay, I think I'll kick it back over to Rachel to cover the buildable land inventory.
Thanks, Jamin. So Jamin has covered sort of the demographic trends and population projections, and then the assumptions about the amount of housing and the type of housing that's needed. And I'm gonna cover what we call a buildable lands inventory. So that's really looking at, okay, well, where can that housing go? And is there enough buildable land within the urban growth boundary in Yahats to accommodate that housing? So in terms of our process for doing this, we take a look at what we call the residential land base. So first we look at, okay, the urban growth boundary and only the parcels within that urban growth boundary. And then we limit it to zones that allow residential use. So within Yahats, the commercial zone allows residential use as well as all the residential zones. So the analysis is limited to those zones. And then we take all of that filter and we look at classifying the parcels by development status. So we're really looking for areas where there is potential to develop, whether it's vacant land or partially vacant land. And in the next slide, I'll go through the exact definitions of what those things mean. Whether it's undevelopable for different reasons, it's public or exempt, things like right-of-ways or public facilities, or it's already been developed. So in the case of our analysis, we're really only interested in the vacant and partially vacant residential land, and then looking at the capacity there. We know Yahats is between the ocean and some really steep slopes with some wetlands. So part of the process is removing what we call environmental constraints. And those include the 100-year floodplain and floodways, significant wetlands, as well as slopes over 25%. We kind of go through all of these in a process, and I'll pull up some maps so that there's more, you can see kind of what we do to get there. But we go through all of these levels of filtering, and we end up with a net buildable acreage that we calculate. So a little bit more about those classifications. As we're looking at any given parcel in the city, we're looking for vacant land, so meaning no structures or very low improvement value, less than $10,000. We use the Lincoln County assessor data, as well as aerial photography and local knowledge. So we met with the project management team to get more insight on specific parcels where we may not have gotten all the details right. We also look at partially vacant parcels. So by our definition, those are larger than half acre. They're occupied by use, but there's enough land to be subdivided without rezoning. And this follows the safe harbor method established by state statute for cities with populations below 25,000. We take out anything undevelopable. So anything less than 3,000 square feet is likely too small for residential development. And then, as mentioned, we also take out public and exempt parcels. So anything restricted by existing public uses or exempt from residential development, things like parks and schools, conservation easements, roads, common areas held by HOAs, as well as land held by cities, counties, state agencies, utilities, and service districts. So these are some maps that sort of take you through the steps of the process. So first of all, we have our residential land base. So anything in a color on this map of the urban growth boundary in the city, it's pretty much the same boundaries, but we are looking at within the urban growth boundary, where residential use is allowed. So that's this first level. And then we're taking a look at those classifications. So the vacant, the partially vacant, all the categories that I listed on the previous slide. So Everything in red here is what we have classified as vacant. The yellow is partially vacant. Blue is exempt. Purple is undevelopable. And then everything else that you see here, which I just want to emphasize, only includes the areas where residential uses are allowed. Everything else in that kind of lighter white color is developed. So we are really looking at within the red and the yellow parcels, what the capacity is for future housing development. But we're also looking at those environmental constraints. So looking at this map, if you see the brown or orangey areas, those are slopes greater than 25%. The green are the FEMA flood zones. And then the sort of cross-hatched blue areas are wetlands. And so as mentioned, we take, you know, those first two layers, we sort of layer them on top of each other. We put these environmental constraints on. And then what we're left with is what we're calling our buildable land inventory. So you can see these gray cross-hatchings are showing areas that are vacant and partially vacant, but they're also constrained. So those constraints are taken out of what we identify as buildable area. And then, so when we go through this zone by zone, which is what we've done here, we look at all of the land within the zone. So that's the gross acres. We look at what of that is constrained by those environmental constraints. When we take that out, and then most of the gross acreage is developed. So we're really, as I mentioned, only interested in vacant and partially vacant acres that are not constrained. And so we go through a process and then we get our buildable acres within each zone. So looking at this table, you can see overall Yahats has almost 80 acres of buildable land. Most of it is in the R1 single family residential zone, with some in R3 and R4, a little bit in R2, and an even smaller amount in the commercial zone. And one point that came up as we were kind of looking through, okay, where is the vacant and partially vacant land that's not constrained? In our meetings with the city team, we were pointed to there are some very large tax lots that are classified as vacant and partially vacant. They do have some environmental constraints, so that's not shown on this map, but there are also some other constraints such as access issues. There may not be access to these parcels with something like a road. The slopes may be a further challenge to putting a road in, infrastructure. So there are some additional difficulties that we are not technically including in the environmental constraints, but we're just pointing out as other potential barriers to housing development in some of these larger parcels. And they are within the R1, so the single family residential zone, as well as the R3 zone, which allows single family, duplex, and multifamily housing. In total, it's about 20.7 acres. That doesn't include the constraints, the environmental constraints. But if you remember back to the number within Yahats that is buildable, it's about 80 acres. So this is about a quarter of the land that is buildable might potentially be difficult to develop. And that's important as we think about the capacity for development to really kind of focus on in terms of some of the tools and the strategies to produce the needed housing. And I'll go through next steps just so that we talk about what we're doing now. And then I also mentioned our housing implementation work. So this is a schedule of the project. We kicked off in February. We're doing this first piece which you're hearing about today, the housing needs analysis. Jamin went through our housing needs projection. I just went over the buildable lands inventory. And we also kind of put these two together and also include some assumptions about density and build out to develop a residential housing needs analysis to kind of show, okay, of the needed housing and the needed housing types, what can be produced as kind of a baseline in Yahats, and then what are some of the limitations and potentially strategies to produce that needed housing. So today we're just going through these first two pieces at our joint meeting of council and planning commission. And looking at the clock, we'll have plenty of time for questions, which is a great thing. And then we sort of filter all these things. We're looking for your feedback, as Jamin mentioned. So we'll ask you a few questions to kick off our Q&A session. But we're really hoping to kind of fine tune the projections and then connect them to measures to accommodate needed housing. And so once we have a sense of sort of what the data show, we will have a community meeting. So a community-wide meeting where we will be there in person in September to present some of the information that you've seen today to the community, kind of say, okay, we've crunched the numbers. Here's what we see. Here are some of the demographic trends. Jamin presented some slides about rent burden and income levels and commuting. All of those things will distill into a public-facing, easy to understand summary of the work that we've done in hopes of really getting some pointed feedback from the community about measures to accommodate needed housing. So whether that is zoning, different policy tools, we'll kind of get a gauge of what the community is concerned about related to housing, and then what some of the potential solutions to issues may be. And that will help us kick off our housing implementation plan work, which will really be kind of, okay, we've seen all the data, we see what the community needs or expects in the future. How do we get there? What does it look like? How do we implement strategies to produce that needed housing? Right on the tail of the community meeting will be another joint meeting of the Planning Commission and City Council, so that you're having an opportunity to review all the work that we've done and really weigh in on our projections, and then some of the tools that we've identified and help make recommendations and provide input. So we get what the community feels like is appropriate in terms of addressing the needed housing projections. And so I'm going to open up, I'm going to stop sharing my screen for a second, so that I can see, I don't see anything in Q&A and I don't see anything in chat, but I wanna invite everybody. I see we have 23 attendees with us today. If anything that we have covered was unclear, or you have questions about it, or you just have thoughts about housing and Yahats that you wanna be sure we hear today, this is your opportunity to do that. We have plenty of time to go through some questions. We also have two specific questions that we want feedback on. I see Lance with a hand up. So I'm going to Lance, are you able to speak?
I am. I think so. Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear?
I unmuted my session.
Okay, we hear you.
Okay. I guess my central question was that you mentioned that between now and 2043, Yahats may need roughly 294 more housing units. And you broke those down in the various different types based on what types we have now. And then you went into the BLI, the Buildable Lands Inventory, and it appeared that most of the places where there were buildable lands inventory were also in areas that you identified as having a slope of greater than 25%. Those lands tend to be kind of expensive to develop. I was thinking if you had some insight you could share with us about, you know, what the challenges are to do that development and what methodologies we could use to reduce costs.
That is an astute observation that you're making. And yeah, we covered it both with the constraints and then also that additional identification of the difficult to develop parcels. So that's exactly what it's about. They're not impossible to develop. They're difficult to develop, meaning that extending infrastructure and access roads and, you know, sewer and water can be very costly, if not prohibitive in certain cases. And so I think we will be thinking through, I mean, typically there are, you know, there are a handful of tools that can be used. There are things like public-private partnerships where the city maybe identifies land that it wants to see developed and is able to partner with a developer on specific projects and public improvements. In the case of Yahats, it may be that looking at the easier to develop land, there is a lot of potential to add density there and make it easier to develop additional housing in some of the, you know, more central areas within the city. And that would be a tool indirectly to sort of meet the demand by sort of easing the development process in some of the other areas. Jamin, anything you would add?
No, that's, I think that's the two prongs there, right? So, you know, you have a certain amount of housing demand in those areas that are more difficult to develop, housing that's built there is likely to be more costly. And as we also know in Yahats, many of those areas that are difficult to develop also have views and they're up on hills. And so they're also likely to be more expensive housing because, you know, views are part of the equation in price. And so I think the city can play a role in a few different ways. I think that probably the most important one is to help to provide some support for the infrastructure that's needed to be able to develop some of those areas. We don't know what that is yet. Probably going to take a closer look at that in a later stages of the project, but it might be water infrastructure or sewer. Sometimes that's harder to make work in some of those more hilly or sloped areas. And so the city kind of making an investment in some public infrastructure that can unlock development in some of those areas is one thing they can do. The city needs funding to be able to do that, but that's one of the ways they can help reduce the cost of housing development.
Thank you.
And I see two questions in the Q&A, so I will get to those. Stephen asks, could you talk more about the existing housing need? All the numbers seem to be about future population growth. So that's a good point. And just to be clear, it's not that everything kicks in 20 years and that's the time to start thinking about it. It's really from today gradually or just in steps, incrementally, how do you meet what is anticipated to be the future housing demand? And beyond that, you know, in meeting with our city team, we've heard in Yahats, there's a need for workforce housing, housing that's affordable, whether that means rent stabilized or just at a price point where people with incomes, and we looked at the income data, it's attainable for locals. So that's certainly part of what we know to be the existing housing need. Jamin covered the vacancy rate. So Yahats has a very high rate of vacant, seasonal, and for sale housing. So typically second homes, vacation rentals. The city has a cap on the number of short-term rentals, but also given the number of housing units and housing production, that's something that is potentially something to explore and get community feedback on in the future. And if there's something that I haven't mentioned that you see as an existing housing need, please share it, because that's why we're doing these meetings, to kind of get a better sense from people in the community what you see as the critical needs at the moment. Mm-hmm. And then
because I'd say, even though a lot of our data is about the future housing need, the strategies that the city could implement as a result of this project will also benefit existing residents that may want to or need to find different types of housing within the community, or change something about their existing housing to make it fit their needs better. One thing that's been brought up is accessory dwelling units. So the city could look at different ways to try to encourage and support people who want to create an accessory dwelling unit as part of or on their property as a way either to supplement their income or to downsize into a smaller unit. So that's definitely something we want to hear about. And like Rachel said, if you have insights into some of the housing issues that existing residents are experiencing, we would welcome that feedback now.
And I see a second question asking, why is it necessary, from the person's name is anonymous, why is it necessary for Yahats to grow? And I think—
I can take this one, Rachel, if you want to. Yeah, I just was thinking about what you're referring to the last one. This is a question we get often when we're talking about housing and housing planning. The key thing to understand is that the city in many ways does not have isn't really able to control whether people want to move here or not, you'd move to Yahats or not. And so the city can't close its doors and not allow anybody else to move into Yahats. That's just not an option that's available. And so the question really is not whether to grow, but let's come to terms with how much the city is projected to grow and think about ways that the city can manage that growth in a way that protects the existing character of the community, that benefits the existing residents, and that kind of manages it in a way that that benefits the whole community and is done in a smart and thoughtful way. And so that's really our goal here. We're not coming to this project with the objective for Yahats to grow more than it currently does. We're just taking growth as an assumption that it will happen and thinking about what the city can do to manage it best.
We see Jacqueline with a hand up. Jacqueline, are you able to unmute? Great.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for all this. I just want to go back to that housing mix for futures, because one thing that I was looking at, we've got townhomes and plexes, we've got single family, manufactured homes. What isn't listed on there, and I don't know if it's a separate category or not, but mixed use development type, either micro apartments or housing of that sort wasn't in that mix. Another element are like a cottage cluster. I didn't see that in the mix anywhere, where that would fit the architectural character of Yahats. And we do have some, I think we have some smaller lots where smaller cottage complex could be put on. If we review our zoning, review our setbacks and stuff, but I was wondering if those could be added into that housing mix.
Real quick on that, Jacqueline, the cottage cluster, I think we would categorize that under townhome/plex. It's a broad category, but The reason we use that is those are the most common types of, basically they are usually smaller units than a single family detached house, but they also may be for ownership. And so that's kind of the distinction there, but I think cottage cluster would fit into that type, and be one of those types that would fill that need. And then the either mixed use developments, so apartments above commercial, or I think you mentioned micro units. I think those would both fit into multifamily. But generally though, you know, we're trying to make a projection here at a pretty high level, just so we don't try to get too precise with, you know, the projecting 20 years into the future. It would be false to say we could be so precise as to project the need for all the various subtypes of these housing units. So that's part of the reason we don't show them here. But it will be something we look at when we evaluate the city's zoning code, which is our next step in our other policies, is for those somewhat unconventional housing types, does the city or does the code get in the way of being able to build those? So that's part of the equation, just not really shown in this projection.
Oh, okay, thanks. Because I was under the impression that townhomes and plexes tend to be attached and that cottage clusters were detached. And so that's why I just thought there might be a difference. The other one I thought I had when Lance asked about that, the steep slope and that area of difficulty of building, we have as you mentioned, we've got a really high percentage of second homes here. And since we're including that need and that assumption that we're going to continue to have that, I know in our meetings, we made the assumption that a lot of those second homes were going to end up being the ones built in those more difficult to build areas. And if that's the case, there are ways of kind of trying to lure people to build up there as opposed to where we've got flatter, more easily built for more residential. So I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Sure, I mean, I think one thing that we could think about related to those kind of more difficult to develop areas is if the city, knowing that land is scarce, wants to try to make it easier, less costly to build there, but also may want to make sure that any new housing that is provided does go to permanent residents, then there may be ways of structuring public-private partnerships to require that. So one example that comes to mind is a city of Portland provides reductions, or I think even a waiver of system development charges, which can be up to like $10,000 for new accessory dwelling units. But it does require that if you get that waiver, that you don't use the accessory dwelling unit as a short-term rental for like a period of 10 years. So there are ways of kind of, if the city is interested in encouraging housing that's for permanent residents and is going to make an investment toward that end, then it could be structured in such a way to make sure that happens.
Thanks.
And one thing Jamin mentioned is we want to get, you know, part of the reason for having this meeting, apart from us just presenting information and talking, is to get your input. Do you think that our projections should match this existing housing mix? Do you think that Yahats should plan to produce the same mix? So a roughly 80% of the new housing built in the next 20 years will be single family detached. 7% will be that townhomes, plexes. And given Jacqueline, your comment, I think it's fair to open that up to, you know, we would call that middle housing. So including cottage clusters and things like that, multifamily, manufactured homes, should it match, or is there interest in potentially incentivizing or giving to focusing on producing a different mix of housing. I see Lance with the hand up.
Yes. Well, and you touch on a very important topic for us. There's certainly a large group of people who at least have been thinking about how we might be able to incentivize more multifamily dwellings over single family residential. However, you know, we also have a lot of retired people who have bought lots here. And when they retire, they're planning on building a house and they're not going to sell their lots and they're not going to build apartments. They're going to wait and they're going to build single family dwellings. And like Jacqueline mentioned, you know, many of those will be in the locations where the views are nice, maybe up on the hillside, and where the building costs are higher. But in other areas, I think it's safe to say we would like to see some ways that we could incentivize and maybe even restrict to multifamily housing.
Yeah, you make a great point. I mean, some of the options that may be explored are in certain areas having a minimum density standard. So for new development, if it's in one of the higher density zones, you are required to develop at a minimum density. So, you know, I don't know off the top of my head what that might look like, but it would basically say if you're in one of the higher density zones, you have to develop at least a minimum number of units on a certain size lot. And that could be a way of incentivizing multifamily development. And, you know, I just want to emphasize, depending on the size of the lot, things, you know, something like a duplex or putting in an ADU, we call it gentle density, sometimes is a way to add density that doesn't feel oftentimes, you know, of course, there's support from certain folks for just build more housing. We need all sorts of housing, multifamily housing. And certain people really feel strongly that they may not want that on their street or in their neighborhood. But there may be approaches that the city can take to kind of meet everybody where in a way that is popularly supported by telling the story about the housing need and also kind of community priorities that have been established through this series of conversations that we're having. I see Jacqueline with the hand up.
Yeah, I've got a question.
There's a question in the Q&A too. I wanted to make sure we got to.
Oh, sure. Thanks.
We'll do that first.
Yeah. So someone asked about water sustainability. And they asked, we already have a shortage issues, which can only become more challenging with projected growth. It is important for the city to study their water supply and their water infrastructure to make sure that it can handle projected growth. But it is not part of the scope of this study. So as I mentioned, we're really looking at, we assume that projected growth will occur over time, and just really looking at what form that takes and how to best meet the need for a variety of housing types. Not to diminish the point or the issue, because it certainly could be a critical issue. It's just not something that we're studying and looking at solutions for. So if anyone from the city wants to chime in and provide any more information on water and growth issues, then please feel free to do so. But just wanted to address that.
I see Max with a hand up. Go ahead, Max. Or maybe an accidental hand up.
Oh, Max may need to be promoted to a panelist to speak. I'm not sure if he's here. I'll do it. There we go.
Oh, there we go.
Okay, try again, Max.
Can you hear now?
Yes.
Yes.
It's actually me who's asking, Fran. You know, this whole discussion is what's called a distribution equity discussion. So how do we distribute? But you can't get equitable distribution when you really don't have the resources. And what you're saying about the amount of available land and the difficulty building, I think that the supply side of this, the ability to actually build more, is not very great. And as you said about not having a choice about whether we grow, I don't think that in that situation, putting lots of restrictions on how we grow is going to really solve that problem either. But I just have a question about the percentages you gave earlier. I was confused by the fact that 61% of the housing is second homes or vacation rentals, and also 60% of the houses were owner occupied. Can you clarify that a bit?
Yes.
I couldn't make sense of that.
So great question. We use US census data, and then also the census releases something called the American Community Survey. And so we use the way that they classify housing and occupancy and also tenure. So occupancy means, I mean, that should be fairly straightforward, but either housing is occupied, there's someone living there full time, or it's vacant, meaning it's somebody's second home, or maybe it's on the rental market, or maybe it's for sale.
How can it both be 60%?
So, right. So the vacant, the amount of vacant housing is 60%. The amount of occupied housing is 40%. And I understand this is confusing. So that's the total amount of housing units, you know, some 700 something units in Yahats. Of the occupied housing, so 40% of that 700 something, 55% is owner occupied. And I can't do math in this way. So hopefully you're following along, but 55% of the 40% is owner occupied. And then 45% of the 40% is renter occupied. Does that help clarify?
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. And good question, because I know we threw a lot of numbers at you. So that's why we're having this Q&A. Any other? I see Jacqueline with a hand up. Go ahead, Jacqueline.
And I think I might have had a senior moment here, so we might have to come back to me. But let's come back to me.
Okay. And then why don't we? I see Betty. Let's promote. Betty, are you able to unmute?
Yes. Hi. I've lived here 20 years, and during the 20 years, I taught basic preparedness and found out a lot about my city of Yahats. You talk about the 25% of buildable land on slopes. Have you considered that Yahats is truly in a tsunami earthquake zone? And because a lot of timber has been cut down up on those slopes, that hill possibly will come down. And so people that choose that area to build probably will have to pay two times, three times more than we would. Well, most all of us are going to have to build for that event, because it will happen. It's not if, it's when. And so I would hate for us to encourage a lot of people to, I hope they understand that that's possible in the future.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. It's quite relevant, you know, as a coastal community, looking at the tsunami inundation zone. And then that might be something that the city chooses to look at if it's thinking about, you know, policy and different incentives. So it may be a policy choice, and you know, I understand our audience is our policymakers here today. So it may be a policy choice not to provide incentives within the tsunami inundation zone. depending on the incentive. Or it may be just, you know, any housing anywhere is the way that the city may choose to go. I can provide an example. So I live in Newport, and I worked with the city to develop some affordable housing development incentives, including a property tax exemption. And what the city in Newport chose to do is to not allow that property tax exemption to be applied within the tsunami inundation zone, as well as the geologic hazard zones. So kind of connecting those two things that you mentioned. Yeah. Beyond that, you know, it's a personal choice. If somebody either doesn't care or doesn't know, I mean, hopefully they do know what they're getting into, but oftentimes people just make the choice. And like you said, they can build to a seismic standard. It can be very expensive. They may decide, and I heard this, I'm saying this because I heard it from many people working as a planner. They've come to Yahats, or they're going to continue to live in Yahats through their final days. And if they go, they go. And I know that's a bit morbid, but I mean, that's not like an unpopular sentiment. So it's kind of, we don't know when it'll happen, but it's an important thing to think about and plan for. I agree with you.
Thank you.
And I see, Jacqueline, you still have a hand up. Did you?
I've seen your moment passed. So.
Okay, great.
All of these issues, the land constraint, the water constraint, the steep slope, all of these things, and our aging population in some ways, and our workforce housing, lack of housing, all lend themselves for people to understand, I think, where that housing mix that you showed earlier, what we think we need to have, needs to be looked at a little differently. So to look at it as a continuing of 80% single family houses, those constraints become almost untenable, right? But if we switch that and we look at looking at more density, looking at smaller homes in smaller lots, and however you want to design it, but that's the direction that we need. People are moving here. Whether we like it or not, people are moving to the Oregon coast. We also have, as you pointed out, a lot of older people that would probably like to downsize and stay within their community and not have the expense and the work of a large home. They don't have those options right now. Economically, our businesses depend on having workers be able to be here. If they continue to have hours closed or limited hours because they simply can't find people to work, our economy is at risk. When it comes to water, multifamily houses on a plot of land tend to use less water than a single family house. So, you know, doing that kind of more densification, it isn't necessarily the numbers of people, it's where you put them and how you put them. And that's why you've brought this to the community, for the community to hear these different options, but know that we have the power right now in planning to do it, as you said, it was a well thought out plan to really look at what we're doing and how we're doing it, and to do it in the most carefully planned way for the community as a whole. So I don't know how many people, because I can't see, are on this call, but it would be really helpful for people to share this, if there aren't a lot of people on here, to share this with fellow citizens, discuss it, and then submit questions, submit ideas, submit concerns, because that's the only way we're going to be able to move forward doing this in a way that is thoughtful, because people are moving here and people are going to want to build here. And we do have some of these constraints. So I just thought I'd throw that out there, that building more densely, having more people on one spot of land as opposed to spread out as we have been doing, I think that that mix of future housing does need to be re-looked at a little bit.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jacqueline. I agree on many of those points, given the existing trends and issues we're seeing. So based on, you know, our analysis as planners and how we think about housing issues, we would advise to consider a higher mix of multifamily and townhomes or flexes. But that's why we're here too. We want to hear what the others on the call here, planning commissioners or counselors, we'd like to hear you weigh in on this issue as well. Looks like Julie has her hand up. Julie Bailey. Okay, Julie, you should be able to talk now if you unmute.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Great. I wanted to thank Jacqueline for clarifying something because I wanted to ask a question. Is it possible to more closely identify the available buildable property that's in non-constrained areas that might be potentially a candidate for like more density and smaller homes or clusters or that kind of thing?
Yes, and we have done that a bit, and that'll sort of be then when we reconvene in September, you'll be looking more closely at that analysis. We didn't want to throw everything at you at once, kind of thing. It's understanding there's a lot of technical information here. So that's a very good point. And we kind of our next step, that residential land needs analysis piece, we're looking at, okay, within the zones and what they allow and what we understand about the constraints and then the land that's available for building, how many housing units could we expect as a baseline if nothing changes? So that's what we've done as the next piece. And in September, we haven't set the meeting dates yet, but the community will see some of that analysis in a very public friendly, you know, community facing, understandable way. And then we'll ask people for things like that. Could you see, you know, adding density strategically in certain areas? Is that a strategy that might have some potential, you know, for support in Yahats? From what we've heard today, which is just a small subsection of the population, it seems like there is support for adding density. But yeah, you're exactly correct. We're looking strategically, not just kind of, okay, we have a table with some numbers in it, but what does that actually mean on the ground in terms of things like a minimum lot size, or Jamin mentioned accessory dwelling units, and that's something the city team has shared with us. We'll take a look at the code and see, okay, of the housing types that are needed or desired, are there any challenges within the code that prevent those from being produced, and what are they and what might the city do about them? And I also am just reminded, we appreciate everybody who's been able to come today. There's about 22 attendees in our webinar audience. So that's great. Also understand that 3 o'clock on a Monday doesn't work for everybody, which is why we have recorded this. And we'll work with the city to get this recording up on the website. So for those who were not able to make it, if they're interested, and please, this is, you know, something Jacqueline mentioned, but please tell your neighbors and your colleagues and your friends and your family members who may be interested in these things. Here's what the city's working on. Here's how to get the information. And then Jamin and I will go ahead and put our email addresses in the chat. And you can also contact the city team directly if you have comments or you think of things after the meeting, or maybe you didn't have time to read through the memos in detail, but now you're interested. Please feel free to, you know, take another week and just think about what you might have to say or ideas that you have. We would love to get your ideas about solutions and strategies. So all of those things, you know, just let people know. You all have a reach within the community. So share the information, let them know what's going on. Tell them that in September, there'll be a community meeting where we'll invite everybody to come and share their ideas and have a conversation about these things as well. I see Max with a hand up.
Hey, this
is Stephen. Fran.
Hello.
Go ahead, Max.
Well, this is Fran again. I just wanted to clarify the point that got lost last time. I want to emphasize the support for Jacqueline and your discussions about density strategies, because that adds to the supply, that increases the resources. I want to lodge a warning against just making rules about distribution. Like you can't build unless you build a certain density. I think that is the wrong approach. But I think the real approach is the harder one, which is actually to build more. So.
Yeah. Very good. That's a great point. I think with any regulation, there is always a balance between how much the code should prescribe a certain thing versus simply encourage it. So it's always a balance. You're trying to strike, and hopefully we can try to recommend some standards that would strike that balance.
I see in the Q&A, we have another question from Stephen. Does the city have policies that would prevent mixed use development so that residences could be added above businesses? The city does not have that policy. They allow right now residential uses. So any residential use that's allowed within the residential zones is allowed outright in the commercial zones. So you do see some mixed use development along 101, for example. There may be other challenges. You know, we haven't dug into the code, as Jamin mentioned. We'll be doing that as, you know, part of our next steps. There may be other barriers to housing development in a mixed use zone.
And just to give you a little preview of that, because this is one of the challenges is that even though the city may allow it based on the zoning, there are a number of other factors that go into play and whether it's feasible or practical to develop that. But other things that we will look at in the zoning code are things like the maximum density that's allowed that may become a barrier to mixed use development. The minimum parking requirements can become a barrier, just trying to accommodate that amount of parking that would be required for the new residences on a site, especially if it's a smaller existing site. A maximum building height, I was just taking a quick look at the commercial zone, the maximum height is 30 feet right now. That really only allows for a two-story building, and you don't actually see too many new mixed-use buildings that are two-story. So allowing for up to three stories may be one strategy there to try to make that more viable to do. There's a whole range of different things that can restrict or prevent the types of development the city may actually want to see, and that would help support your housing needs. And we'll be kind of daylighting those and facilitating some discussion about those in the next stage of the process.
I see Jacqueline again. Ahead, Jacqueline.
Yeah, I don't know if Catherine is on this call or not, but she could probably clarify this. It's my understanding that we used to allow mixed use automatically, but I believe that several years ago, the Planning Commission had changed that. Because not long ago, we had somebody come asking for a variance who had already built one mixed use, and apparently that shifted. So that is something that has to be looked at here. The other thing I was going to ask you guys is, how often have you seen communities where a commercial area has now pretty much been filled up with single family houses? So people get the assumption it's really a residential street, but it's a commercial street. A slow change of that, because that's one of the few areas you can have that kind of change, right? Would be on an area like that. How do cities tend to incentivize those kind of slow changes? We've also have a lot of our areas that are zoned for anything above R1, like R2, 3, 4 in commercial, we automatically allow a single family house to be built on there. Instead of mandating maximum or mandating a minimum density, disallowing that single family automatic build on those higher zoned properties where it becomes a conditional use requirement. You know, why do you have to build a single family house on this one particular lot? Can't you do X, Y, or Z kind of question? So I just thought I'd throw those out there.
It can be. Go ahead, Jamin.
Yeah, I was just saying there are a few different ways that cities can try to. So I guess legally, the city could do they have plenty of leeway in how they regulate housing in the community. It's more a question of policy and balancing different priorities and goals. But in terms of discouraging single family housing in certain zones, yeah, there are many ways to do that. Rachel mentioned a minimum density standard is one way. Outright prohibitions on single family housing are another way. Depends on where you want to target that. If you want to target it to a specific area, you could create an overlay zone, or you could create a new zone district, and so that it doesn't apply to areas where you don't want that to, the regulation to apply. So lots of different options, and many cities do consider those and have those on the books in their zoning to try to encourage a wider variety of housing types. They really have to be well thought out and well kind of calibrated. So you don't want to discourage one housing type and expect developers to build another housing type, or home builders or homeowners to build another housing type, but make it also very difficult to build that one. Then you're just going to get no building at all. So it's a mix of things. You know, discourage certain things, but also really encourage and support others.
And I see the city manager, Heidi Lambert, offered to answer a few questions. So go ahead, Heidi, if you had any input.
Actually, can you hear me?
Yes.
It's Catherine. I had my hand up and I realized why nobody's calling on me, because you thought it was Heidi. No, I logged in on the city manager's Zoom account. So yeah, just a couple things on to answer a few of Jacqueline's questions. Oddly, we did remove mixed use as a permitted use in our C1 zone. And I can't tell you what the thinking was. It is allowed as a conditional use, and she was right. We recently had a conditional use application and there was no pushback to complete a project that had been started about 15 years ago. So that's certainly something we could take another look at. I really cannot remember what the rationale was behind that. We also have allowed in some cases for an affordable housing project, we've allowed an increase in the 30-foot building height for exactly the reasons you guys mentioned, that it just kind of made the project work to be able to get that third story in there. And in the two cases I can think of, it wasn't affecting anybody's view anyway. So that was kind of a no-brainer.
Thanks, Catherine, for those clarifications. And I'm looking at the clock and want to respect everyone's time. So we have 1 minute left till 4:30. Just as a reminder, our next sequence, we'll be having an internal project management meeting next month, but we'll really be focused on the community meeting in mid-September, where we put all of this together and we have some potential measures to accommodate needed housing. And then we are going to the community for input and opinions. And then we'll be meeting with this joint planning commission city council group once more in this phase of the project, so that we are making sure that we're getting everything. You know, we heard what you told us, we're reflecting it accurately, and we're moving ahead to the housing implementation plan with the support of policymakers and the community. I put it in the chat. I put my email address in the chat and also answered a question with it, but take some time if you need it to review everything that we've presented today. Think about if any of the classifications may be off or you've thought about it in the projected mix of housing. You would like to make recommendations to change it. We heard some support to actually add more of the higher density housing types. Jamin, anything else to add?
No, I think that covers it. Thanks everyone for your input.
Thank you, everyone. We'll be posting the recording of this meeting with the assistance of the city on the city website.
Rachel, can I ask one question of Catherine? Because I believe that when that one development that the height was allowed, they also gave a break on parking. And I just want the community to realize that is something that's already been done, I believe, but Catherine's got to correct me if I'm right or not on that.
Actually, they gave a break on the same developer's next project because he made a very convincing case that the people that he was aiming to serve were not two-car households. And we had held him to the regular multifamily parking standard So he took pictures of his parking lot, different times a day, different times a year, and convinced the planning commission that our standard was overkill.
Great. So parking standards might be something we dig into a little yep. bit more as we're doing our audit. Okay, thank you, everyone. That ends the meeting, and we will hopefully see you in September and keep you posted on the city site.